Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. This is the third talk on the Noble Eightfold Path, and today I will be talking about the Moral Discipline Group, which consists of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. In the Serene Reflection Meditation Soto Zen tradition, which we are, the 16 precepts would need to be included in what we think of as moral discipline. These are the three refuges, the three pure precepts, and the 10 great precepts. As right understanding deepens, as we are able to let go of whatever arises and trust more, following the guidelines set out on the path and in the 16 precepts becomes what we would naturally do. Right understanding leads to right thought, and they both lead to right speech, right action, and right livelihood. If in our thoughts we indulge in greed, anger, and delusion, our speech and actions will be very much influenced by that. We all have our karmic tendencies, our habits, our conditioning, views, etc. We have the self to look at and let go of as best we can. Even when we have some experience of the truth, we still have much work to do and need these guidelines to help us. In studying the Eightfold Path, what comes through very clearly for me is the Buddha's great compassion. He is truly teaching us how we can find the cessation of suffering and the joy of awakening. It isn't easy to follow this path, and we need to be very kind to and accepting of ourselves. Bhikkhu Bodhi says something very interesting in his book, The Noble Eightfold Path. Though the principles laid down in this section restrain immoral actions and promote good conduct, their ultimate purpose is not so much ethical as spiritual. They are not prescribed merely as guides to action, but primarily as aids to mental purification. As a necessary measure for human well-being, ethics has its own justification in the Buddhist teaching, and its importance cannot be underrated. But in the special context of the Noble Eightfold Path, ethical principles are subordinate to the path's governing goal, final deliverance from suffering. In the deepest sense, moral discipline is not for the sake of becoming a better self, but for the sake of being one with the truth or Buddha nature, living from our Buddha nature, letting go of all that gets in the way, and acting as a Buddha would act. And I think this is very important teaching of the purpose of the path. Bhikkhu Nyanasambano points out in his book, Longing for Certainty, something in my mind that is similar to what I just read. The Venerable Ananda once asked the Buddha about the benefit and advantage of good moral habits. The Buddha replied that it was non-remorse. I think we can all relate to this, and its opposite, which is, of course, remorse. Questioned further about the benefit of non-remorse, the Buddha said, "The benefit of non-remorse is gladness, which leads to rapture, to tranquility, happiness, concentration, which we'd call meditation, realistic knowledge and vision, revulsion and dispassion towards clinging to worldly things that are impermanent and create suffering, and the knowledge and vision of deliverance." Clearly, the Buddha is describing here not just the blessings of miscellaneous virtues, but a definite progression of wholesome states which leads on to full emancipation, or we would say awakening. The morality, The consistently good behavior, which he so often emphasizes, certainly has many good consequences in the development of a person's character and in pleasant relations with other people. But it is interesting that here the Buddha singles out non-remorse as its particular benefit and advantage. Why should what seems merely a lack of something be deeply noteworthy? Let us consider the mental effects of self-restraint, moral discipline, and honorable adherence to noble standards. When one is training oneself in this way, evil causes are removed. There is then no regret, no guilty apprehension, or grief based on ignoble deeds. Not doing harm, not causing misery to living beings, one has no fear of bad consequences, no self-disgust, no regrets to struggle with. This is a perfectly natural result. Being conscious, moreover, of having done right, having strived to become a better person, one feels mental relief and lightness, a kind of freedom which is a positive blessing in itself. The Buddha's main teaching is that there is suffering and there is a cessation of suffering. And this is what he's helping us to find, the cessation of suffering. Not judging ourselves for being what we call a bad person, or not trying to be someone who is, you know, a great person, but finding the cessation of suffering. That is the purpose. When we keep to the precepts as best we can, trying to let go of a grip of our karmic tendencies, we lessen the misery caused by their breakage. And we all probably know the mental suffering caused by breaking the precepts, especially if it is done deliberately. As we go on, we see in more subtle ways how much our thoughts, speech, and actions affect our level of suffering. Moral discipline can then be seen as how we act outwardly and also how we become inwardly. Moral discipline allows us to be in harmony with ourselves and with others. It helps us to cleanse our karma and not create more karma. It allows us to be at peace. So now I'll go to the third path factor, which is within the moral discipline group. It's right speech. And 5 of our 10 great precepts are concerned in some way with right speech. So it shows you the importance of right speech. And I actually read that we create the most karma with our speech because we use it so often. Okay, so the precepts that are concerned with right speech are: do not say that which is not true, do not sell the wine of delusion, do not speak against others, do not be proud of yourself and devalue others, and do not defame the 3 treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The Buddha taught that there are 4 types of speech that must be avoided when one wishes to know the truth: false speech or lying, saying that which is not true, which is one of our precepts; slanderous speech; crude or harsh speech; and idle chatter. The 4 types of speech to cultivate are truthful speech, uplifting kind speech, gentle speech, and moderate useful speech. In 8 Mindful Steps to Happiness, Bhante Gunaratana describes what the Buddha said about truthful speech. The Buddha described the guidelines by which he himself decided whether to speak or remain silent. If he knew something was untrue, incorrect, or not beneficial, he would not say it. Such speech the Buddha does not utter, he said. If he knew that something was true, correct, and beneficial, then the Buddha knows the time to use such speech. When his words were true, correct, beneficial, and timely, the Buddha spoke regardless of whether his words would be unwelcome and disagreeable to others or welcome and agreeable to others. Deeply compassionate and fully focused on people's well-being, the Buddha never spoke only to be a people pleaser. And Bhante Gunaratna goes on to say, we can learn much from his example. When I am tempted to speak words that do not meet the Buddha's guidelines, I remind myself that I gain nothing by speaking, nor does anyone else gain, and nobody loses by my keeping quiet. This teaching is something well worth contemplating because it encourages compassion and consideration for others. To follow the Buddha's guidelines for right speech, one needs to be very mindful. This is what I have found. Nobody gains anything, as Bhante Gunaratana says, when we react negatively without thinking first to what someone has just said to us. It just creates more suffering for everyone. Mindfulness gives us the opportunity to see what we are about to say and refrain from saying it if it might be harmful. It is the non-existent, insubstantial self that feels threatened and feels a need to defend and protect itself. And it is the self we are trying to let go of. I read that truthful speech that is beneficial and timely is very important to our training because we are seeking the truth in following this path, and to deliberately lie goes against that very truth we are seeking. Besides being very harmful to our own training, it can be very harmful to others. Venerable Master Sin Yun says in his book, Being Good, lying is particularly reprehensible because lying is a deliberate attempt to increase delusion. Most people are already lost in delusion. To deliberately add to the problem is to turn away from the Bodhisattva way and from the infinite compassion that inspires it. Lying is very damaging because it ruins trust and it causes honest people to doubt their own intuitions. And I would definitely agree with this. I know for myself how lying and deceit can confuse the mind of those who are lied to and cause them to doubt their own instincts. And this, in my mind, is very harmful and creates a lot of suffering. I think it's pretty obvious what slanderous speech and harsh speech are like, but idle chatter may need some explanation. Master Sin Yun quotes from the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra about idle chatter. Idle speech can be defined as one of the following: false speech, ill-timed speech, speech without significance, speech employing inaccurate terms, thoughtless speech, raucous speech, disorganized speech, pointless speech, speech with no larger meaning, or speech that contradicts the Dharma. Idle speech gives no value to others. It is a waste of time to listen to. One who frequently engages in idle speech is in danger of creating dangerous attachments to this world of delusion. Whether speech is considered idle chatter or not depends, in my mind, on the motivation and purpose of such speech. When our speech comes from a good motive and is grounded in our training, then I wouldn't call it idle chatter if we are simply talking with each other and enjoying each other's company. If we're relaxing with other people, if we're promoting friendship, encouraging friendship, helping someone to feel comfortable. If it isn't really grounded in our training and is self-centered, comes from a feeling of neediness, a desire to get people to like us, reassure us, admire us, or just to hear ourselves speak, then it is good to look at these inclinations and think before we speak. When we speak from a sense of neediness, worthlessness, wanting reassurance or something from others, we actually harm ourselves. We are denying our own completeness just as we are, denying our own Buddha nature. We're reinforcing the delusion that we don't already have what we need. The fourth path factor is right action. According to the path, right action would include refraining from killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. Not indulging in intoxicants is sometimes included as well. And if we were to add, do not be angry, all our precepts would be included in the Eightfold Path. Right action is not only thought of in terms of refraining from that which causes harm, but doing that which encourages harmony and the well-being of ourselves and others. We do that which encourages compassion, caring about others, and respect for all things. And you can see that which we're trying to refrain from encourages the opposite of this. The Brahma Viharas, the four Brahma Viharas, or what has also been called the four immeasurables, could be considered part of right action. Because they can arise naturally from our Buddha nature and can also be encouraged through our ongoing training, they are loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, which is rejoicing in the good fortune of others, and equanimity. The six paramitas can also be studied in terms of right action. They are generosity, precepts, patience, vigor, meditation, and wisdom, which we can encourage and are also the natural result of our training. We can practice the paramitas no matter how we may be feeling. And Reverend Master Mahan has often encouraged us to be kind, no matter how we're feeling, not to be so focused on ourselves and our own suffering, but to do that which is good to do, that which helps other beings, and in the end actually helps ourselves, because following the four Brahma Viharas and the six paramitas actually helps us to open to our true nature. Another aspect of right action is doing that which needs to be done. What needs to be done does not mean making a list and then trying to get everything on that list done, but doing what truly needs to be done, that which comes out of our meditation, the coming together of compassion and wisdom. And this would include the willingness to do what needs to be done, because we might see and know what really needs to be done, but not actually want to do the right thing. We may want to rest instead or do something we might find more enjoyable, easier, or less stressful. And yet there it is in front of us, calling to us. And I'll give you an example of what arose for me yesterday morning. I have been so focused on preparing this series of talks that I have felt I can't do much of anything else. I can't volunteer for other things that might need doing, or maybe I can only volunteer minimally. And then this morning I realized that this attitude was not encouraging right action. Perhaps this talk I'm working on doesn't have to be perfect or the most wonderful talk ever. And it is more important to be less focused on myself and my talk and more aware of what is needed within the community. Everyone is very busy, and I need to help out as well. It is seeing the bigger picture and not being so focused on what I might think is so important or my worry over not getting something done. It doesn't help to talk about right action when I'm not practicing it. It's trusting that what truly needs to be done will get done if we open to compassion and wisdom, when we get our own agenda out of the way. And what prevents us from doing what is, quote, good to do at this moment? Worry is a big factor, also fear, our karmic tendencies, greed, anger, and delusion, pressure, getting locked into something, we must do this. Opinions, caring what others think about us, trying to please. Meditation, mindfulness, and the willingness to see our humanity and shortcomings with kindness can help us to overcome these obstacles. Also, seeing the results of our actions, the suffering we create for ourselves and others, can help us see what we are doing more clearly and motivate us to change. The fifth path factor is right livelihood. And this factor could use some explanation. Bhikkhu Bodhi says, right livelihood is concerned with ensuring that one earns one's living in a righteous way. For a lay disciple, the Buddha teaches that wealth should be gained in accordance with certain standards. One should acquire it only by legal means, not illegally. One should acquire it peacefully, without coercion or violence. One should acquire it honestly, not by trickery or deceit. And one should acquire it in ways which do not entail harm and suffering for others. The Buddha mentions five specific kinds of livelihood which bring harm to others and are therefore to be avoided: dealing in weapons, in living beings, including raising animals for slaughter, as well as slave trade and prostitution, in meat production and butchery, in poisons and in intoxicants. Any occupation that would require someone to break the precepts should, of course, be avoided. Even with avoiding the occupations mentioned by the Buddha and others we might think of in this 21st century that he might not have mentioned, it's not always clear if certain work situations are actually right livelihood. Some work, in and of itself, might be considered right livelihood, but the conditions in the workplace are not suitable and encourage someone to break the precepts. I spoke with one of our lay trainees a number of years ago. He had worked in an office where it was encouraged to be deceitful, to lie to clients. He had taken the precepts and really didn't want to lie. However, he didn't know what would happen to him if he went against what was expected. He finally made the decision not to lie or be deceitful. He just quietly went about his work honestly, without judging or criticizing others. People first wondered about him, but then gradually they were drawn to him, and they stopped lying as well. The whole atmosphere in the office changed. So this is one way of working with a situation that would in and of itself be right livelihood, except for the conditions. You might find it helpful to read the section on right livelihood in 8 Mindful Steps to Happiness. Bhante Gunaratana gives some very good advice about how to know if work is right livelihood or not. Some questions he recommends asking yourself are, first, is my job an inherently wrong occupation? That is, does it cause harm by definition? Second, does my job lead me to break the 5 moral precepts? And for us, it would be the 16 precepts. Finally, are there other aspects of my job that disturb me and keep my mind from settling down? And Reverend Master Daizui mentions in Buddhism from Within another aspect of work that might be worth looking at. Is the work I'm doing utterly useless? It may not be doing any harm, but does it do any good whatsoever? And I'd like to add, that the important thing about doing work that we consider right livelihood is to remember to do the training within your work situation and not see your work as separate from the rest of your life. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.